This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. We have a Bald Move Pulp movie. Me and Jim are kind of delighted that we get the we don't have any appointment pulp that we have to do this week, so we could actually do like a fucking pulp movie. And guess what? It's the 25th anniversary of the release of Star Trek First Contact, a.k.a. the only great Next Generation Star Trek movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think you can argue that some of the others are fair or decent, but this is the only one that like I actually unabashedly love. Came out in 1996. I was just a baby. It stars all the original cast. Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, LeVar Burton, Michael Dorn, Gates McFadden, Marina Sirtis. It adds Alfre Woodard, who turned out to be a really fucking good actress. You've seen her in Captain America Civil War, Luke Cage, 12 Years a Slave. She got nominated for an Academy Award for Cross Creek. James Cromwell, who you've seen in the Babe Pig movies and Green Mile, L.A. Confidential.
New Pope.
Finally.
Yeah.
The new Pope, right. And then finally, Alice Creege, who I have enjoyed of late in the Christmas Prince trilogy on Netflix. She's also featured in Thor the Dark World and got her start in Chariots of Fire. It's directed by Jonathan Frakes, the Commander Riker. And it was based on a screenplay written by Brandon Braga and Ronald D. Moore. Jim, what do you think of this movie?
I love this movie. This is easily, without a doubt, my favorite Star Trek movie, original series included. I know a lot of people love Wrath of Khan. It's just not quite my era of Star Trek. This is right in my wheelhouse, man. I love the crew of TNG. I love how much fun they have with this movie. You can tell, like, there are scenes with Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis where it's just like obvious they're having a ton of fun filming this thing, and so I have a ton of fun watching it. And I think it's, you know, it's in the tradition of those older Star Trek movies. This thing gets going right off the bat. You kind of get a couple of cool shots of Enterprise and a slow moment or two, but then bam, the story just gets a crisis happens and the story goes.
It's very action oriented. Doesn't, you know, have a lot of big picture things to say.
Thematically, it gets there, though, I think. And it's an interesting side of Picard that we don't often see.
And what saves it is this, how just like based in the characters, everything is like, you know, that is like, this is, first of all, you got one of the great Star Trek villains of all time before it had kind of gotten diluted by some, you know, familiarity breeds contempt from Voyager.
Sure.
So you got an apex Star Trek villain.
Yeah.
You got an A plus, but you got a Shakespearean performance by Patrick Stewart that actually calls for it. You know, this gets really fucking operatic in places, literally. In some
literally. It's got time travel, which is one of my favorite subjects.
Time travel, which is
anything.
So my favorite Star Trek film, and maybe we'll get to do it because I know it's 35th anniversary is coming up soon. But the Voyage Home, the one about the whales.
Yeah, 4?
It does have some in common. Yeah, Star Trek 4, they go back in time. I think Star Trek 4, a lot of these Star Trek movies are a lot shakier on like the science stuff. Like, for example, the Enterprise is patrolling the Romulan neutral zone at the start of this movie, and they just decide on a whim to go back to Earth to save it from being attacked from the Borg, and they get there while the battle is still raging. Like, that is, as far as I can understand, a several week long trip. You're going to the very edges of the border of the Federation to its very heart, but they get there in a couple hours. It's shit like that.
Jordy Goose, the engine
rules are very sure. It's the warp drives they activated the special defend Earth this top military speed.
Yeah,
but the thing is it doesn't matter because what this movie knows, probably because Jonathan Frakes, I think, is a pretty good sci-fi director, is that the action and the plot can be a little silly as long as you care about the characters and you clearly understand their motivations and you understand the stakes and you are completely locked in on all of those on like three separate plots. And it's just, it's great. It's yeah, by far, far and away the best modern Trek film.
Yeah. And I think the script is, you know, it might have a couple holes here or there, but mostly it's pretty tight. There aren't a lot of why don't they just kind of moments where there are in like regular Star Trek episodes. Like, why don't they just solve this with the transporter? Why don't they just solve this with the whatever? And they have to like patch a bunch of things like, oh, the ionization of the reverse nanoparticle. Yeah. They don't have to do a ton of that shit here. Because, you know, once you're back in time and you destroyed the Borg and now they're on their your ship, then there's not a lot you can do about that easily, especially once they have control of engineering. So, yeah, I think it yes, there are a couple of holes, but I don't really notice them too much. And so this whole movie feels like it's pretty tight. And then when you get to the characters, then, yeah, the characters that we spent at this point, 96, at Star Trek Next Generation's run was over.
Yeah,
entirely.
We were entering our 10th
like
year of
fourth
of
DS9 season.
Yeah,
so I
yeah.
I love these characters already.
We were in the third Voyager season.
Oh shit! Right, those were running concurrently, weren't they?
Concurrently, yeah. They don't. I think Deep Space Nine got like a one or maybe two season jump on it, and then yeah, they just cranked another one out.
And then also, this movie looks, I think, great. They've taken all the stuff
for
that you're familiar with.
$40 million budget. Holy shit. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a couple of shaky effects, like the Borg Queen stuff is a little shaky here or there, when you first introduced to her, but after that it gets
years
better
later too.
But they've updated the lighting. They've updated a lot of the sets. Yeah. They've updated the uniforms. Just all around, it looks like more money has been put into this thing. The lighting actually really impressed me in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, you know, I've gone back and kind of reevaluated Generations. As you think Generations is terrible, I actually think it's a pretty good, like, double episode Star Trek The Next Generation with just noticeably better lighting. The thing that this $40 million budget comes because they have to build very little in the way of new sets. Like, they cannibalize the sick bay from Voyager.
Okay.
The I forget where they got the bridge from, but like almost everything is the engineering was a redressed Next Generation set. Like most of the stuff other than like the deflector dish set probably.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the shit that they did in the holodeck, most of the stuff most of the stuff was in existence.
Gotcha.
But it does. Yeah. I think that's one thing I was kind of dreading when I was watching is like, oh man, is this going to have aged poorly? And it hasn't really. And you mentioned the script. I was reading some of the background on this. Like, we dodged some fucking bullets, man. One of the earlier scripts was suggesting that Enterprise, the Borg go back to the Renaissance period
when we have a
and
whole
try to
movie.
Destroy like modern civilization before it even, and like, you know, they're going to have Data become to Da Vinci, and Picard is going to be wearing tights, and there was going to be a sword fight involving like, I was looking at this, I'm like, who jumped in the way of this bus and took the and got bodied because they are a hero.
I love those scenarios in a weekly format where I know this is just going to be a fun week and next week you'll get back to regular Star Trek. But as a movie, no.
But some of those impulses, I think you start to see not be suppressed in future Next Generation, you know, movies. Like,
for sure.
You know, fuck it. You know, why not? Why not have an all-terrain vehicle? Why not have Data singing Gilbert and Sullivan show tunes? Why not? You know, it's like it gets a little much.
I do think there are good why not reasons for that. Like, I can tell you why the Borg wouldn't want to go back that far, because I think, you know, part of the Borg, I mean, the Borg are always about, you know, we're going to add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Right. They don't want Renaissance tech. They don't want, we just invented a catapult. No, no, they want the good tech.
They're trying
that
to find a sweet spot between technological development and lack of resistance.
Oh, you can destroy yourselves with the nuclear weapon? Great, great. We want that shit. We eat that for lunch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, makes sense.
Where do we go from here? Do you want to? Because I've got like just shit tons of notes.
I know people are probably super familiar with this movie if they're interested in a First Contact podcast, but maybe we should run down the plot, exactly what happens, because we've mentioned a lot of it, but haven't done that.
This has a similar structure to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, in that an old foe with a lot of enmity between the captain returns. In this case, it's the Borg, a biological a cyborg collective that has crossed swords with from a far-flung reach of the galaxy. It's crossed swords with the Federation many times, had personally captured and enslaved Captain Picard in a very memorable two-part arc in Star Trek The Next Generation, something that keeps coming up throughout the series. And now the Borg have come, and they're coming straight to Earth. It's the invasion kill stroke that the Federation has been dreaded for years and years. And Picard's been sidelined because Starfleet Command does not want him to be there and be an unstable element. Of course, Earth gets attacked. It's a desperate battle. Picard can't obey orders and stay at the neutral zone for the whole thing. He has to come in there, saves the day, blows up the ship. But the Borg are able to send a probe back in time, and they're going to Borgify the whole fucking world. Well, Captain Picard can't stand that, and he orders his ship through the temporal wake to follow the Borg into the mid 21st century on the eve of mankind's contact with the Vulcan Empire, the Vulcan race, the Federation. Essentially, mankind reaching out and joining the Starfleet. And the Borg are going to stop all that unless Picard can track him down and kill them all. So that's the stakes. All of humanity, very high, against a foe that Picard is traumatized and triggered by. There you go. And will he be able to do it? There's so many great plots, because there is the Earth plot, the Zefren Cochrane plot, you know, the mankind's first warp drive plot. There's Data being seduced by the Borg. There's Picard's personal battle against, you know, his white whale and war against his worst nature. How do you want to start talking about this, man?
Maybe we can start with Picard, because the movie kind of starts with Picard, right? I mean, the idea that Starfleet doesn't quite trust him with a Borg scenario. Why do you think that is? They call him an unstable element. Do you think it's because they know there might be some want for revenge, or do you think it might be because they think he's compromised and could be still influenced by the Borg?
I think that for sure Picard is in reality emotionally compromised. And now whether it's wise to keep Picard away from the battle, you know, like evidence would say it wasn't. I think, you know, Picard could have turned the battle a lot quicker and saved a lot of lives, because he has that unique connection to the Borg. Somehow he's still like able to hear their whispers and whatnot. There's still a little bit of cybernetic shit in his brain.
And he also just has the knowledge of the way that the Borg construct their ships now. And I don't know if they've been faced with another Borg cube between Best of Both Worlds and now. I can't quite remember, but he would know how to, you know, hit its weak point, and he does exactly that.
But I don't think it's as crazy as everyone on the Enterprise thinks, that like maybe we keep this guy who has this weird connection to the Borg, who's still obviously traumatized. The You know, when he shows up for his mental, his annual mental health checkup with Troy, he sits down and just starts screaming Borg, you know, like, so, Captain, how are you? Borg! Yes, it's, I can see where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. The body horror stuff at the beginning of this is pretty great.
Do you remember Jonathan Frakes directed a episode of Picard that featured like some real squeamish body horror too? I think secretly Frakes likes horror. I wonder if he's actually, you know, because he's done a lot of genre work. I wonder if he's actually directed any or just straight up horror stuff, because I noticed there's a lot, especially in the early goings of the Borg when they're taking over the ship.
Yeah,
it is shot like a conventional horror film.
Yeah, I mean, there's a drill going into Picard's eye at some point. You know, the Borg tech pops out of his cheek while he's looking in the mirror. Then you got
that's classic double fake out. You know, you got the drill going in the eye, then it actually makes contact, like, and then Picard's like, oh, terrible, I'm still processing all this trauma. What a terrible nightmare. Splash face on the water. Ah, stuff exploding out of your face. It's great. It's a good jump scare. I know it got me back in the day.
Yeah. And you're right. Picard has some kind of sixth sense almost for the Borg. He's got some connection lingering because he's having nightmares about them as they show up. Did he know that they were here? I don't think he knew that they were here until he walked out onto the bridge and somebody comes up and says it's the Borg, or he gets like a call that says, and he goes, I know it's the Borg.
It's because they've fucked with the environmental controls and turned it into a humid hothouse.
I thought it was way before that, at the beginning, the very beginning of this movie. Doesn't he get a call from someone or a report or something?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know exactly what you're referring to.
Okay. And I think he's already had this nightmare and he's like, yeah, I know, the Borg.
Hmm. He's got a six. But they established it. Yeah, he can like hear whispers, like Data outright communicates with them through it. At the end of the movie, so it is something kind of like a supernatural link. Here's something I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the Sovereign class starship, the Enterprise E?
Not my favorite. I prefer D. I think they got a little too busy. I prefer the D. I think they got a little too busy with E. I think E has too much Aztec-ing, too much going on the surface, and I don't understand the real reason for it.
So there's probably some bullshit tech reason, but I don't know. It seemed like in that era things were going cruftier, and you know,
and they've gotten like way cruftier since. Like,
holy shit,
like, the new stuff is Aztec to hell and back.
Yeah, like, you know, like look at this, and then you get like the ultra realistic stuff they're doing on the Expanse, where everything is just like, you know, completely opposite of conventional starship design. And I'm with you. I really like the Sovereign's lines. Mm-hmm. I really like how it's kind of like a compromise between the Excelsior class, like the small, Voyager, long and sleek, and also the D.
Mm-hmm.
But you are right. What you call the Aztec-ing, just the like needless plaything and. But I think that's also they're since these movies tend to be more action oriented, I think the Sovereign also looks a bit more nakedly military.
Oh, for sure. You know? Yeah, I heard the guy who did the uniforms, the longtime costumer for Star Trek, actually militarized their uniforms specifically, was trying to make it more militarized.
Right.
So, I think they came away with a more military look to all this.
Which is a bummer because that's like, you know, not core Star Trek, but it does make a cool looking action piece for this movie.
And when you're talking about the era of DS9, DS9 was a more militarized show by far. I mean, they're on a Cardassian space station, which looks military as hell, hard angles everywhere. Yeah. And then, you know, the uniforms that they created for this, I guess, went back into DS9 in season 5 somewhere. Mm. But that show had a harder edge to it. And I think they were kind of leaning that direction with Star Trek as a whole at that point.
What do you think of Geordi showing up with blue eyes?
I think it's great. I really, you know, his banana clip is classic, but this is like a futuristic look. It just gives it another layer of something cool to do, and it didn't feel like Geordi, you know, would have a problem with this. I mean, I think he's always wanted to have some kind of like quote-unquote normal eyes. I don't know, but these are clearly bionic, right? There's some kind of like machine eyes that still let him see, I think, in the spectrums he's used to. They're just,
or like, definitely yeah, like we get a good POV of him. He's able to do the thermal stuff, but they're definitely bionic. And I think they're cool too.
I think they look cool. Things where it's like very striking.
The banana clip is iconic, but you know, LeVar Burton has been fighting with one dramatic hand tied behind his back the whole series. Now he's able to get his eyes out, some of the most expressive part of your features, and I think LeVar Burton doesn't have a lot to do in this movie, like a lot of the background characters, but he does a lot with what he's got. Actually, I think they did a good job with everyone, that like almost all of the original crew had a chance to shine, had like a purpose-built scene written for them where they could strut their stuff, because obviously the things are going to be dominated by Picard and Data.
Oh, for sure. Even Barclay gets one, right? Reg gets even in there with
fucking, they bring Barclay back. A quick scene. Great. Did you see we didn't talk about some of the guest stars too.
Oh yeah.
Adam Scott shows up as the helmsman for the Defiant.
Was that him?
It was fucking Adam Holy Scott. Holy shit. Absolutely.
I thought he would be way too young at the time, but I guess not.
Well, that's the thing. Adam Scott is like Paul Rudd old, and these guys are not aging. Lieutenant Hawk, the character is played by Neil McDonough.
Yeah.
Who I love from Band of Brothers. I love from the heaviest Justified 3. I don't know why this guy's not a bigger star. I think he's great. But Adam Scott apparently auditioned for this role, didn't get it, but he's a big Star Trek fan. So he's like, I'll take anything. I'll just take a borderline extra. But I thought that's fun. And they also, the other memorable cameos is they got Ricardo. What's the guy, the emergency medical hologram?
Picardo. Robert Picardo.
Robert Picardo. they got him and whoever the fuck plays Neelix.
Yeah, I don't know his name.
I remember that being fun because I had already kind of like, you know, checked out of Voyager. I think I stopped following them around the second season. But still, you know, I actually thought the EMH was a great character.
Oh, yeah. And the EMH, he's my favorite character from Voyager. I had to pick. It's him and then it's Janeway. But like, he's great. I hated Neelix in Voyager. So,
oh, God, Neelix is the fucking worst.
Yeah. Having him show up was not cool. But I don't know. Also, they gave an update to kind of everybody's look as well. Right. Even the regulars. Gates McFadden looking
Gates
great.
Gates McFadden
in
has
this movie.
Never looked fucking foxier.
Go ahead. No, I want to hear more about Gates McFadden looking foxy.
Well, I was just going to say if you show up to our Star Trek live watches, you know that I kind of have a thing for the chief medical officer of the Enterprise and her cut, her highlights, makeup, the everything is just
yeah. They've got like three different colors or something going on in her hair. It's very intricate, but it looks fantastic.
It's like I just want to brush it.
Marina Sirtis gets to let her hair down literally a bit in this.
Yep.
Because it's normally tied back, but here
not rocking the Betazoid frizz.
I want to say the only person who maybe has a worse haircut in this is Jonathan Frakes. Which is ironic, considering he had the most control over anything
in
this production.
You're right. He was just a little,
it's a little spiky.
A little tousled. Little kind of not regulation.
Yeah.
I remember him being kind of sloppy looking in Generations, too. I think he was wearing a uniform three sizes too small for him, but also, the hair and makeup wasn't really working. I want to play a game with you in this podcast. This is going to be the first installment.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Called Cool or Cringe. You know, we like stuff as a kid. Some of that stuff doesn't age. Some of that stuff in retrospect is cringe. Sometimes fuck it, it's still cool. Data's rebellious to hell with our orders. Controlled look around the bridge to check the temperature of the room. Cringe or cool?
Cool. It's the first indication you have that his emotion chip is still on. Or that he turned it on, right? Since the end of Next Generation.
Unfortunately, you're incorrect. The correct answer was cringe.
Why is the correct answer cringe?
Because there is some good Data stuff in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, because Data is a fan favorite, that just like in Generations where they went way the fuck overboard on this stuff. And then most of the Star Trek movies, they commit this sin. They just put a little bit too, there's just a little too much. I don't know. Like Data comes off like a hall monitor here. Like this movie's PG. We've cursed in Star Trek before. I don't think we need to do, I don't know. I think it's cringe. I think it's cringe.
Okay.
But, we're 50-50 on this one.
I might trade with you. Well, I want to see what other ones you have. If you haven't gotten all of them by the end,
you can definitely pop some cooler cringe questions to me.
Okay.
I got another one. I got something else to talk about.
All right.
This is the definitive answer to the phenomenon of Worfing. Worf kicks so much ass in this movie. You know, do you know the what I'm talking about? The concept of a character being Worfed?
Yeah, just getting their ass kicked by anybody and everybody, even though they're supposed to be the badass. I don't know.
Yeah, like Worf is the heavy of Star Trek, and mm-hmm. he is the most powerful, dynamic character. And yet, and because of that, if the show wants you to take a new big bad seriously, they just have him come and just kick Worf in the nuts, throw him through a bulkhead, flip him on his back, you know, it's just all kinds of things.
Which can this backfire, movie, but yeah.
It can backfire, because then it's like, well, how fucking tough is? Right. I've seen his ass, he's like, you know, this old lady is handed his ass. Yeah, she's a shapeshifter. This 98-year-old admiral's thrown him through a bulkhead. Yeah, he's got a parasite inside of him, but like, come on, Worf.
Right.
But Worf kicks so much ass in this movie. He's super cool.
He does, yeah. Him and Data, the pair of those two, are incredibly cool in this movie.
That's the other thing, as I love anytime that Data gets to kick ass, because mm-hmm. you know, Data's mild mannered, he doesn't have an ego, but like, he's also a robot, and when he goes into kill mode, it's just neck snap, neck snap, neck snap, neck snap. Yep. And it's so much fun to watch him wade through a fucking army of Borgs snapping necks.
Hell yeah. No, that's one of the best scenes in the movie, is when they get into those hallways for the first time and things go wrong and they have to fight their way out. That's fantastic.
Okay, another installment of Cooler Cringe. This is going to be a controversial one. The casting of Zefram Cochrane, mm-hmm. James Cromwell, cool or cringe?
Incredibly cool. It's I love James Cromwell. I think he's perfect in this role.
Do you think that he played, because like the thing about Zefram Cochrane is he's like this blend of unlikely characteristics. He's like very mercantile. He's like the worst of our capitalistic instincts before we cast them off into the beautiful, free post-scarcity Star Trek. He is kind of a slovenly drunk, and he's also a brilliant scientist. I feel like Cromwell does two of those three things really well. And the other stuff is pretty fucking, and the other thing is cringe. Which one do you think I don't think he does well?
The brilliant scientist.
Yes. Okay. Strangely, yes. Yeah. He does not seem like a smart person in this film. And he's James Cromwell. That should come free.
It does come free for me. He doesn't do anything that seems smart, right? All he does is flip a couple switches. That's the smartest thing he does in this whole movie. Flip some switches and It pop a neon disc into a drive. You're right. There is no demonstration. There's no display of his intelligence. And he plays the other parts of that so well. Like the drunk, the mercantile nature. You almost think maybe he's not that smart, but he built the ship.
Like what I needed to see him do is like, there should have been a debate between Geordi and like Barclay about some kind of obscure warp drive. And he comes in there and corrects him.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's actually this thing and this thing. But like, it just feels like this is all just happening to him.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of doubt that he would have got to space and meet the Vulcans if it hadn't been like, this is a paradox. Like, if the Borg hadn't attacked, I don't think mankind makes first contact, because this guy's not doing it.
You might be right.
Fucking senior crew, bridge crew, the bailout is fucking hobby project, you know?
Yeah. No, I've got so many questions about the time travel stuff and the change of scenario here and how it affects history and all that stuff. So we'll get to that stuff. But yeah, I really like James Cromwell. I like that you brought up this like capitalist, instinct that we have. And it kind of pairs really nicely with the need for revenge that Picard experiences later. Because these are all things that we're talking about having grown beyond by the 24th century. And it shows us that, like, okay, they have grown beyond money, right? But there's still this kernel of humanity. Money is like a human construct that I don't think is ingrained in us. But revenge absolutely is. Like, there's some kind of need for, you did something wrong to me. I need to get some justice. I need to get payback for that. And I love the pairing of the two in this movie.
Yeah, that's some good analysis. I want to go back to Cromwell real quick.
Yeah, please.
90% of Cromwell not working as a smart guy is his fucking hat. True or false?
True. True.
I mean, what the fuck? Because in the next installment of Cooler Cringe.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the 21st century clothing?
It's not what I'll be wearing in 2064, but
I'll fucking wear Picard's peat jacket right now. Pea jacket right now.
Like, yeah, that wool.
That like wool trencher. Is like, yeah, I'll walk. I'll wear it right the fuck now.
All right. I won't be wearing what Data's wearing anytime soon. That's for sure. Everything is like
Data's
piping. It's like, yeah, you know, kind of quilted piping looks. A lot of wools, a lot of like heavy materials. I assume there's some nuclear fallout that's, you know, causing the, I don't know, we get global warming and then it reverses because of the nuclear fallout. Yeah, who knows what kind of crazy shit.
All humans in the mid-21st century are colorblind, which explains Data's outfit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's nuclear winter and it's freezing there, so they got to wear these heavy materials like wool.
I think it's mostly cool, except for Cromwell's jacket, or except for his Cromwell's hat. Yeah. Data's whole outfit. And that's about it. I think everybody else looks pretty good.
One more thing about Cromwell while we're talking about him. I couldn't help but notice when he's standing next to Jonathan Frakes, who I know is a tall man. I know he's somewhere like in the 6 foot range. Cromwell kind of towers over him.
Cromwell is fucking tall.
James Cromwell, I looked
like
it
up. 6'6".
James Cromwell is built as 6'7". 6'7".
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you can that will see power. It.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's a big fucking dude. Not smart, but big.
He doesn't look smart, but he is.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Alfrey Woodard, man, she does so much great work, and she has such great chemistry with Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the jump, like the moment she takes him hostage and like has got that ray gun, and like, you know, Stewart's like genuinely terrified that this lady's gonna start pushing buttons. Like I bought every single thing, and sometimes like I feel like the lady they got to act opposite of William Shatner, like she has to be like pretty tough with him vis-a-vis the whales and whatnot, and like sometimes I don't feel like she completely held her own. But like Alfrey damn near blows Patrick Stewart off the stage in some of these exchanges.
If he doesn't have
the goddamn ship and
yeah, no, if Patrick Stewart doesn't get the scene where he gets to say, you know, the line must be drawn here, this far, no further, that stuff, then yeah. She might have. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like you have to have someone like Woodard there to make that other the get Picard that Shakespearean. Because else it just is ridiculous.
I was wondering, you know, if this would have worked with Riker.
I don't know, because like the thing is this also felt like a completely natural progression. Like it didn't feel like that. Like they're just screaming. It just started organically happening because Picard,
he's making a bad decision,
and he's the one that's usually in calm and control and sets his emotions aside, and his crew will follow him anywhere because they think. But here she can see, no, this guy's fucking compromised, even though your crew can't.
Here's why I think this scene doesn't work nearly as well if Riker were the one pointing out that he's being Captain Ahab here. Uh-huh. It's because he respects Riker too much. Riker would say that in a calm voice. Picard would look out the window for a second. He would turn around and say, let's blow up the ship. There wouldn't be that moment of passion and fire because he trusts Riker to call him when he's wrong. Whereas some backward savage from the 21st century. They haven't even gotten off the planet yet. Hardly. They haven't even developed warp drive yet. And she's lecturing him about sensibilities and Yeah. So when he turns around there, I both have a ton of respect for her and a ton of respect for him for making the right call when he sees that he's making the wrong one.
Yeah. The other thing I really like that they do in this movie is the reverence that these people have for Cochran and the Phoenix, like, you know, like Picard reaching out and touching it and, you know, explaining the data, like, you know, how tactile contact can alter your perception.
Mm-hmm.
I love it because, number one, it seems like it's entirely on brand for the show. Like, everyone in the future worships, like, ancient, you know, they're like fucking the worst. They're just like NPR yeah. dads and moms, all of them. They just like listen to classical music. They've never heard of rap or rock. But like I it feels natural, and it's such a great pressure cooker for the character that is Zefram Cochran. You know, this guy who knows. Well, I don't think he thinks he's a fraud, but he comes away thinking he's a fraud after dealing with these people for 5 minutes, you know, that mm-hmm. like history's perception, history's glorification of this man who ushered in this new age of humanity, not for the good of anybody, not for it makes you wonder if like Cochran eventually grows into that role as ambassador for humanity and yeah. like this great thinker, or this is entirely shit that's invented, like tall tales. George Washington cutting down apple trees, throwing silver dollars across the Potomac type of shit.
Sure. I want to say something like that would have kind of forced him to grow a little bit, but it might be a combination of both, you know? I
mean, yeah. Meeting aliens for the first fucking time, it would tend to humble oneself. Sure.
Yeah. And just being in the spotlight. Cause I mean, once he's on the threshold of totally altering his life here, and I don't think he quite understands that. He's just like, he thinks he's going to alter his life by making a bunch of money. What he's really doing is turning himself into a historical figure. And that's the impression that, you know, he gets over the course of this movie is, oh shit, yeah, no, that's scary to me. Because your life changes, right? You can't just be a dude anymore with a bunch of money. You're going to be the guy who invented warp drive.
Plus, I feel like that once you make contact with the Vulcans and you join the Fed, like, humanity is going to change in light speed at that point.
Yeah.
Like, Cochran wanted to get rich, and what he actually did is usher in a post-scarcity society for the Earth.
And
so it's like, there's, you didn't get rich, but there's no more want? Is that the same thing? I don't know.
Sorta. It's pretty close.
It's not for everybody, but no, for
rich people. It's about the same for poor people though. And the other thing too is they make a point of this, like, okay, this is after the Third World War. The governments of Earth have been just completely sent into chaos.
Almost a billion dead.
Yeah, 600 million people dead. So he's kind of taking on a leadership role here as well, right? Like, as the person to make first contact, as the person to invent warp drive, he's now going to be a sort of de facto political figure to them.
Yeah, he will.
Because who else do they go to? What world government,
right?
In shambles do you go to, sure, to say, sure, hey, represent humanity? Well, why not the guy who first shook their hand, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about, like, because yeah, you'd usually defer to the president or to the ruling,
right?
Like, they established the pretty slickly. Like, they spent a little bit of time on this script shoring up. You have to, you know, you have to just kind of go with the time travel thing. But
sure.
By the way, like, I was I can't. How do they get back home?
They slingshot the sun. It's a good question.
Like, I just realized I was paying close attention and taking notes in this movie, but like they just kind of about getting back home. Like, well, you know, we're gonna have because there's also this scene. There's also this late in the movie where Picard had his Ahab moment, and he gives I can't remember if it's Worf or Crusher or somebody, like, standing orders for the crew to find a corner in North Africa and stay out of history's way.
He gives it to Lily to deliver in case she sees Frakes. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, yeah. She runs into Riker. I kind of want to see that as a Star Trek series.
I think a what if kind of series on Star Trek would be really fucking cool.
I would love to see, and they'd have to recast everybody, mm-hmm. but I would love, or maybe they could have the conceit of like the command, there was a lifeboat that had the command crew in it, and it happened to freak accident, just got destroyed. But I kind of want to see the crew of the Enterprise E live like in a what if living out the like a couple season arc of like how they, or maybe even like an anthology. Because like, what does that look like? What does it look like to stay out of history? Not just in 21st century, but like, you're going to keep having kids? Are you going to just like vow to die out? But like, check out that like in a, like a For All Mankind, like every couple like decades, like check back in and see what that civilization is doing. Because I think that's a fascinating concept.
Maybe now's a good time to talk about the time travel stuff, because...
Yeah, let's do it.
I love time travel. It's hard to do a time travel story well. I think this is done pretty well, but it ignores some really big things, I think, about the way that they approached getting him onto the ship, and they're kind of like hand-holding him the whole way. I think the Phoenix was meant to be piloted by him, but also include Lily in it.
I think Lily's supposed to be in there,
on that first flight. So Are Riker and LaForge now two people mentioned in the history books for the inaugural flight of the warp drive? Does Cromwell, Cochrane keep that to himself? What?
That's an interesting, because like, does this Cochrane keep that to himself?
Right.
No matter how drunk he got with the Vulcans that night, does he, I don't know.
Turn on a doobie and he starts talking. Because
there is a photograph of them emerging from the Phoenix, like just people organically taking photographs. There's a photograph of Riker and LaForge sheepishly in the background, kind of.
Right.
You know, like there's gotta be.
It's like, Neil Armstrong is kind of the name for landing putting a foot on the moon first, but also, he had other people with him, and we know their names. I don't know their names, but someone knows their names. The history books do.
But there's just a couple interesting famous photos in history. Like, have you seen that photo of like the 12 guys having lunch on a girder on like the 70th floor of a skyscraper in Manhattan?
Supposedly building the Empire State Building. Yeah.
That one is it's famous, super famous. Mm-hmm. Up until like 5 years ago, the names of two of those men were a complete mystery.
Huh. All right. Like, they were LaForge and Riker.
That's what I'm saying. Like sometimes, like, and people weren't like even like, because like it's just after World War, the records were shit. There's no governments. Like these men are unknown to history.
Yeah,
they've just been lost to history. And like probably if that, you know, if another 10-20 years, because I think it's like someone's great granddaughter, like recognized, like there was some kind of freak thing of like, oh, I didn't know that my granddad is famous, and that. But like if another 10-20 years, we'd have never figured that out, right? So, like, I think now, that's an interesting question.
Okay, that brings me to my second point. Lily. Lily got fucked out of history here. She got a grand tour of the future, and that's awesome. Like, I would love to see the Enterprise and everything, but also,
sure,
she was probably supposed to be on that ship. And I don't care how many, like, let's say that Cochrane says, Lily was on board with me. And then you show the pictures of exactly zero women walking out of that ship, and you're really, she was, because we don't see her here. She's just out of frame.
She transitioned. It was she went in as Geordi, she came back as Alpha.
I feel bad for her because she got screwed out of the history books, but also got to see the future. That's kind of cool.
Usually when people have that kind of deal, they stay. You know, it's the Star Trek 4 whale researcher lady. I got nothing here for me. You fucked me out of my history books. Least you can do is take me into the 24th century where I will want for nothing.
I assume they thought that would be too close to, because they were already worried about this being too close to Wrath of Khan with the Ahab stuff and all that.
Well, that's Star Trek 4. It's not Star Trek 2. So,
oh, is that Star Trek 4?
Too close to Star Trek 4? Yeah, the Voyage Home is Star Trek 4.
Yeah, no. I know, but the Wrath of Khan stuff is where they did the Ahab, from the heart of hell.
Oh, the
I
stab Ahab. But I'm talking about the lady that went back in the future with them was from Star Trek 4.
Yeah, what I'm saying is I think they were worried that this is so close to Star Trek 2, we don't want to also throw a bunch of Star Trek 4 in there, even though because they're already got time travel. That's Star Trek 4. That's close. They don't. They probably didn't want her to go to the future with them for that reason. Because they really didn't want to do the Ahab stuff, but it just worked so well. They were like, fine, fuck it. We'll do Star Trek
2. Why didn't they want to do the Ahab stuff? That's so fucking Picard.
I know.
Because they didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so stupid. Because this is so, I mean, yeah, it's basically the same structure of Star Trek 2. Like, just thematically in that, like, an old foe returns. But damn, it's nothing like Star Trek 2.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I do think I'm super glad they kept it in because this Ahab stuff is the perfect cudgel to beat Picard back to his senses, right? Like, hit him in the literature. If you're going to hit Picard anywhere, it's going to be in the archaeology. It's going to be in the literature. It's going to be in the old classical music. She hits him right where it hurts here. And I think it's perfect.
Talk shit about his French wine.
Sure.
And what's great about it is she uses Moby Dick the way your average 21st century American would use Moby Dick. She's like, you're just like Moby Dick. And he quotes and he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? He's like, Moby Dick. Never read it. Oh, it's so great. All right. Cool or cringe, Jim?
Yeah.
Beverly Crusher activates the emergency medical holodeck or hologram to defend sick bay against the Borg.
So cool. So cool. I love Robert Picardo. I think
ding 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 ding. This is the correct answer. All right. This is cool.
You need a distraction. Cool. It's better than, like, I don't know, setting a phaser to self-destruct or something, for sure.
Mm.
And then Picardo's playing it. So good. So good.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what to do.
The like, you know, Starfleet medical research suggests that the Borg suffer from essentially itchy skin because of all the Borg implants. So he recommends an analgesic cream.
I love that they can still find space for comedy in this movie. And there's quite a bit of it, too. Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes from the Earth stuff, right? With Deanna getting drunk and Cromwell running off and talking about springing a leak and all that. But even on the ship,
when the future installments of Cringe are cool.
Okay. Even on the ship, though, when the Borg are attacking and everybody's in danger, there's still a moment for comedy. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I also love the fact that, like, obviously every Starfleet ship probably since Picard's day on, but maybe even Kirk's day, has had an emergency medical hologram. Why have we never seen them before, Voyager? Well, and Crusher, like, have that line of, like, I swore when I started at when I became a med, I would never use one of these. Like, it was like a personal, no matter how bad it got, I would never stoop to using an emergency medical hologram. Like, the and she's, I like that. I like that. Well, you have a different universe reason.
I was going to say the reality is they hadn't come up with the concept yet.
Oh, but yeah,
and
that's
they introduced it in Voyager, and they
first
thought,
day as a Star Trek fan, you're going to just point out the absurdity. You're not going to try to retcon this thing, and
right.
That's my favorite part about Trek lore is how sometimes they try to tackle that shit. And I thought this was a good way.
Oh, one of those interesting things is so they updated the uniforms for this, right? Made them more militaristic. Yeah. It's now gray shouldered black jacket with their colors underneath as an undershirt, and they took that over to DS9 and they made that the uniform there after this movie. Voyager didn't get those uniforms because they're out in the Delta Quadrant. It's just a small thing that you don't really think about until it's pointed out, and then you go, oh yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
That probably really appealed to Paramount. Like, so we'll never have to invest in new uniforms, new sets, new shuttlecraft. Like, this is, we're just like, this is it, season one, and we're done. All right.
Nice.
That's some savings right there. Cringe or cool? Deanna's moment to shine. She tries to become drinking buddies with Zephyr and Cochran.
Cool. It's not necessarily that idea is so cool, but the way that her and Frakes interact in that scene is just so cute.
Well, Franks is legit cracking up at her routine, especially when she starts poking him in the chest and stuff. Yeah,
I love it.
I wish I had the Blu-ray of this, because I bet there's a lot of like cut. I hope so. I hope it's not a bare bones bullshit, but like there's got to be like 50 takes of this, of them just like improvising and fucking around with each other. I'd love to see that. I got to say that I think that like this is probably kind of cringy, but I don't know. I love these characters. My cousin, who bears a superficial resemblance to Marina Sirtis, used to slay us at like family gatherings and stuff by doing a pitch perfect impersonation of Drunk Deanna. She would just be like, yeah, we don't have
nice.
There's no time to argue about time. We don't have. And then she did the dramatic hair thing. And like, what are we? Yeah. So I fucking love it.
This might be the last element of like, hey, they updated this and that I have to talk about. But the one thing they didn't update that to me, you can't touch, is the Elkar system. The Elkar system is still there. Obviously, you know, it's there in Voyager, right? This is kind of a through line for...
It's here now. We all use it on our cell phones. Lycars is one.
Right. I think the Elkar system is so iconic that it is a huge mistake to have removed it from other Star Treks. I think it is the defining feature of Star Trek.
What Star Treks have they removed it from?
I mean, Discovery doesn't have it, right? Well, I know it's way in the future, but... Huh?
Is it way in the future or way in the past?
I think it's both.
We'll
have to discuss
it.
I want to say it's
both now. If the Star Trek Enterprise did it, or one of these prequels, like, that's fine.
Right,
like,
right.
Yeah.
No, Enterprise is fine.
Anything that happens post-Next Generation, it should be like ours. Because, again, like, we found that this is the way everything's going to work in the future. Like, touch-sensitive, reconfiguring, task-to-task. Like,
sure.
We're never going back, man.
No, and I just think it's iconic. It is, to me, the defining feature of Star Trek. If I look at something and I say, how do I make this look Star Trek? It's the Elkar system.
Go with the Elkars, 100%. I have a question. Why would Dr. Crusher, leading her team out of sickbay, why would they pop out of a Jeffrey tube tunnel outside of main engineering, of all places?
Do I need to look at a Star Trek technical manual?
I don't have one for a sovereign class, but holy fuck, is the sick bay really that close to main engineering? It seems like a bad idea to be that close to the main reactor and potential, you know, like, I thought that shit would be in the saucer section, to be honest. So. You know,
it takes a lot of power to produce the red and the blue. Like, the centrifuges required to get that are vast.
True.
And thirsty.
That's true. Another cooler cringe, and this is a tricky one. The Borg Queen. Both conceptually and how they pulled it off.
Ooh. This might be the one. It's cool-j. It's cool-j. There are cool elements.
It's cool-j. Alice Coolidge.
I don't know, because when we're first introduced to the Borg Queen, conceptually it's very cool. I think the concept gets a little more what the fuck as you go through this movie, but you're hit with this idea of like a cybernetic life form that's sort of loaded and docked into a suit, and it's just a really cool looking thing. But then you see the graphics, and in 1996, they were fine. In 2021, they're not fine. They actually look pretty bad. So, yeah, I don't know. The initial moment where you meet her is kind of cool. The rest of it, I guess I like how seductive she is to Data, but also I don't think conceptually I like the idea of an entity that is this individualized.
That's where, so this is a thing that you do if you're never, this is the supernova of the Borg, and you're going to go out with this major motion picture and you want a personified antagonist and all that kind of stuff. But it really does do a lot of damage to the biological and technological distinctiveness of the Borg.
It gives them a personality, and that is the antithesis of the Borg to me.
100%. Like, if they had like an individualized spokesperson, why did they need Locutus? Like, it retroactively makes a lot of stuff make less sense. And going forward, the Borg was so much less cool. And they just got really overexposed in Voyager. Like when Janeway can take on four cubes at a time, get the fuck out of here. But like, yeah, this they should have said this is the apex of the Borg. And then the Borg Queen's going to be dead. And I guess that kills all the Borg everywhere. And we'll never have to worry about them.
But they were halfway through a Borg series. Yeah,
they just spent $40 million building a lot of cool Borg uniforms and Borg sets and perfecting Borg. And Voyager is over there like, fuck yeah, we get some real villains, boys. And, you know, Seven of Nine is sex in a can, literally. Mm-hmm. And then the rest is history. But yeah, I think it's only cool if this was going to take out the Borg, and the Borg would never, because like it doesn't make a lot of sense, but yeah, it's kind of cool. But like, yeah, the fact that they made this was the beginning of the end for the Borg as serious villains, kind of cringe.
Yeah, I like what they do with her and Data. I just don't think it's a Borg thing.
Yeah, that is, like I said, that's very cool. The whole seduction of
making him a real boy.
And there's a cool like Data goes through different stages where, like, you know, he's got his motion chip turned off and he's just openly taunting them, you know, like, you can't fucking, you know, bust me up, assimilate me, and you're never gonna prevail and all that. And then they turn his emotion chip on, he's kind of shitting his pants and feeling flesh for the first that stuff is all pretty good.
Yeah, they're able it's crazy because this, you know, collective is able to give him come closer to giving him the thing that he wanted than even humanity was able to, right? Even though he could observe humanity and mimic them, they were not able to technically give him a way to be more human. And that's what they were offering. So it's hugely seductive.
Yeah. They give, I really like one of my favorite moments in this movie, because I've always been a big Geordi LaForge fan. Always liked technical geeks. Always liked guys that maybe started off struggling with women. I like how they kind of do his natural, like, they sell his engineer's love of a ship when he's using a telescope to, you know, prove that they're spacemen. And, you know, he's just kind of it's a small thing, but he's looking through the telescope. He's like, ah, there she is. Beautiful. You're like LeVar. He's enthusiastic about this as only LeVar Burton can be. And I fucking love it.
Yeah.
Like he's got a whole meal sequence with Cochran later. That's like, you know, about he does a great job, but like, this is, to me, this is the Geordi moment in the film. Him just admiring the beauty of his ship.
No, I like it. All right. I got a cringe or cool for you.
Okay.
This might be the only Star Trek movie that does this, but was it cringe or cool when Zefram Cochran says you're going on some kind of Star Trek?
Dude, this was the next installment, and unfortunately, the judges are saying this is cringe.
This is cringe. This is one of the big cringes.
But the thing is, it's like, I don't remember too many movies doing the, what is this, some kind of Star Trek? What is this, some kind of galaxy or garden? What is this, like, what is this, some kind of Justice League? I don't remember. I feel like this might have been a trope starter, or at least a trailblazer. So I don't think it came across nearly as cringe in 96 as it does now.
That this I think is you're just right.
Like, this feels hack, and I don't think it was hack back in the day.
Maybe not.
It might be.
It's definitely cringe. I think correct me if I'm wrong, I don't have encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek, but it might be the only Star Trek movie where they say Star Trek.
I think so. It has to be, because Star Trek is not like something, you know, that's like the name of the show. It's not like...
Right.
You know, our 5 year Star Trek is
it's not a mission.
Here's another cringe or cool. The Borg Queen telling Data, was it good for you?
Cringe. It's cringe. And
this seems great. Uh-huh. Like, why do we need to do this Dear Pintow shit?
Yeah.
Like, we get it. It's actually interesting. It's adult. And Star Trek is so fucking juvenile, it can't help but wink at the camera.
Yeah.
You know,
and Spiner's playing it like he's going to have to change his pants afterward. Yeah.
Right. He's going to leak some positronic fluid. But yeah. And that's even fine. Cause, you know, Data's like, it's like his first kiss, first everything all wrapped, first having human skin all wrapped up in one. Mm-hmm. I just thought that line delivery is like, oh my God. Like, This slimy Borg Queen is too sexy. We got to turn down the heat by having her do some fucking, you know, weird science air a pickup line.
Yeah.
Okay, this isn't really cringe or cool. This is just basic Star Trek nerd whining. It's beyond lame that the Borg don't attack until there's an obvious threat. Like, maybe the first few times you meet and you let a few of these monkeys run around your cube because what are they, body lice?
Yeah.
But like, damn, man. They at no point in this movie do they ever are they ever the ones that take the first action, even though the Borg Queen is here and she can commit. Like, mm-hmm. That just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. This movie, you've been over in three different places. If they just go ham as soon as they see these guys show up.
Let me ask you this. Why is the Borg Queen here?
Because this is the most important thing she's ever had to do, this personal grudge against Lacute. That's
really
that's
species number 418796 on their chart is the most important thing. Why? Because of Lacutus? It's Lacutus.
The way she acts like Peg Bundy with she treats Picard coming into engineering like Peg Bundy's treating Al coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning from a bowling date. You know, like, there is levels of like scorn and hostility that this person just shouldn't have towards this other person.
No, she's on her own Ahab mission, I think. Like,
yeah, and
Picard
doesn't make
is
a,
her
it doesn't make whale. A lot of sense. Except for, I don't know, like, they always make humans as the exception, right? Like, we are always,
sure.
You know, we're uniquely to Thor.
Yeah,
and,
Q
and the,
is
yeah,
all about
yeah.
humans. Yeah,
exactly. Like, they're just obsessed with us. We're just that interesting.
Another Borg thing happening here is Picard. I know he's on his Ahab mission here. I know he doesn't really care about his crew in this moment, but when he tells his other crew members not to hesitate to kill assimilated crew members, it's kind of wild to me because he was just brought back from assimilation. He knows people can be rehumanized after the Borg get them. He's just like, nah, fuck them, kill them, don't hesitate, don't even think about how we can bring them back just like they brought me back.
I mean, there's a dark interpretation, which is he kind of wishes his crew had done the same to him, like every waking moment
I think that's
Borg.
It
like he's kind of traumatized and that like he's like they did, like, you know, he's still the stiff upper lip captain, but like my crew did me no favors by rescuing me. I don't think that's what they intended. But yeah, it does seem pretty fucking cold blooded that, but it also makes a lot of sense. Like, you know,
he knows the circumstances
of him being unborgified are pretty,
I think that it's not that it's super dark that he wouldn't have wanted to come back. Because I think he is glad that he's a human again, but also there's an element of like, if we don't prevail here, it's better that they be dead than be a Borg forever, right?
On. Yeah,
because that's his nightmare. He doesn't want to be a Borg again, and he knows that those people would be stuck as Borg, and that would be horrible.
Right. Yeah.
So it's almost a mercy thing.
Because like, that's the thing is like through Picard, we know canonically, like you retain some sort of your awareness the entire time you're a Borg.
Yeah,
and that's pretty fucking, you know, for Star Trek, it's pretty fucking grim dark. Here's something absolutely cool. Everything about the outer space combat. Like the hand-to-hand melee shit that they get up to on the deflector dish is so cool, and it makes me always question why did they not have spacesuits in the original Star Trek? I know it would have been kind of expensive to have, but like, the suits themselves don't cost very much. You can do a lot just like hanging people against, like, you know, your essentially black star drop that you use for the static shots outside of windows, like. It opens up a lot of possibilities, and I never understood why they didn't have spacesuits. And they do a really good spacesuit fight in here.
They do. This is one of those why don't they just moments. We know that the shuttlecraft have transporter capabilities. Why don't they just take a shuttlecraft out there and transport the Borg into deep space?
It's a good question. My only thought would be like they're cut off from the shuttle bay,
maybe.
Or the Borg has cut power. Everything's having to be ran manually, so like they wouldn't be able to do that. But
maybe I'll give them that. I guess
it does give like it's cool. You get to see Worf uses Klingon blades, and he gets a tear in his suit, and he fucking tourniquets it off with like the jugular of a Borg, and
And even Picard gets to show that he's a fucking got the big brain. He, mm-hmm. you know, the Borg have adapted, so he shoots the hull. So they TIL, the Enterprise apparently can't stop a hull leak with a force field or anything. Like that thing is just going to leak for the rest of the movie, I guess. But yeah. It's cool. It's cool. Picard clicking his mag locks off and doing free flight to get over Borg. Like that shit was cool.
There's a little bit of like, what are you doing, Picard? You're taking too many risks here. And I know it's the Ahab thing, right? But the moments ago, he said, don't shoot this deflector array because it has its anti-proton charge, could blow up half the ship or whatever.
Yep.
And then he proceeds to do exactly that. He shoots right at the thing.
But are you talking about like the disconnect it from the ship?
No, I'm talking about to blow that Borg off of the hull. He shoots at the thing and blows a hole in it.
Does he blow a hole in the deflector? Is it like the hull around the deflector? It is the deflector, isn't it?
It's just really freaking close. Whatever it is, it's really close to where he told them it's too risky to shoot these things because we might hit the thing.
Yeah,
he does that. And then he takes a huge risk. And granted, it's only with his own life. But when he does that anti-grav space spin across the top of the deflector array. Man, you missed that. Picard's gone. You missed that grab.
And you're fucked. And you're relying on Worf to come back and 1v3 these guys. 1v4 now because this is where Lieutenant or Ensign Hawk checks out.
Right. That's cool. I like that.
Cooler cringe. Worf looking right into camera and saying, assimilate this.
Cringe.
Pretty cringe.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool when I was a kid, but like pretty cringe. I don't think Worf says that.
Yeah.
Here's a fun thing I noticed on this watch through the movie, and now I'll never be able to not see it. At the 1 hour and 1 minute mark, there is a part where the Borg are re-engaging Data's hand shackles. And he like swings the lock over Data's wrist and then he pats it. The Borg pats the lock the way when you shut a trunk, you like pat the top of the trunk to make sure it's shut. And it's such an obviously human thing to do.
Yeah.
Love it. I fucking love. I'm telling you, go to the hour. It's like 1 hour, 1 minute and 30 seconds. This guy just patty cakes the lock and it's hilarious. It's hilarious that a Borg's doing that.
One of those locks, I think it's on his left hand, reminds me so much of the things that they pull down over you on the roller coaster, and they do that exact motion too, right? They pull it down and then they give it a little like jiggle, the little pat to make sure it's there. Maybe they were just doing that. It is a roller coaster.
Can we get a
thing.
Safety check on Data's left arm, please? Can we? Okay. Yeah, that's the scene where Data wrecks some more shop. He busts free, snaps a couple more necks. I think that's a great scene where he gets his arm scratched. And he can't fucking handle it.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense because it's like, you know, babies scream when they take the most minor damage, because for everything that hurts on a baby is the worst they've ever hurt in their life. You know, like,
sure.
I'm convinced that if you took a 35-year-old man and you made sure that he lived a life and he's never skinned his knee and he falls down and skins his knee for the first time, he's going to bawl like a baby. Because like, why wouldn't you? Like, I actually thought that was really cool. Sure. That like, a person who's never dealt with pleasure or pain or anything is dealing with all this, and it's almost incapacitating. Picard turning on Worf. Worf is actually sneaky the third most important character in this film. He's got a great little arc, and he's like, you know, this is the clearest sign yet that Picard has lost the fucking plot. That of all people, Worf is saying, this is a hopeless military situation. There's nothing left to do but abandon ship and take as many of these bastards out with us as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And Picard is just in complete reality. It is such a fucking, if you're a Star Trek fan from a long time and you go back to these guys from the Chaw Deitch days, Picard calling him a fucking coward. I remember like there's gasps in the audience, man.
Yeah.
And then Worf's like, if you were any other man, I would kill you where you stand. Like, it's so
that line is
goddamn
cool.
Good.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. So and then, you know, the other shoe dropping, right, where he realizes his mistake and comes back and apologizes sincerely to him and tells him, you're the bravest man I've ever known. That's a tearjerker moment. That gets you right in the feels if you're a longtime Trek fan.
Oh, it's great. And the handshake. I also really like Alfre Woodard's epic hand to Crusher's face when she's like, wait, are you, we're just going to stay here and fight this? Then Crusher's like, well, you know, it's the captain. He's made it. She's like, psh, and just goes right in to go steamroll Picard. It's great. It's great.
Yeah, that whole scene is great. I love what they're doing with Picard here, too, because they early on, they're like, you know, when Alfre Woodard, when Lily comes up to the ship and she is like, boy, you must not get home much if you're out gallivanting around the stars and so far away. And he's like, well, I've come to think of the ship as my home. And then the Borg start taking over, right? And you understand Picard's not going to let this happen because the ship is his home.
Castle like, doctrine. He has no duty to retreat.
And he knows that this is the last stand of humanity, too. I mean, there's a little bit of like why Picard is going so hard here.
It's a home invasion. It's also the Alamo times a trillion, you right. know, like it's like literally this is for all the marbles. And it's also your. Yeah, it's.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was an accident or what, because God help these guys. They can't write a movie script to save their life. But like everything just fucking works. Like,
yeah.
Even all those thematic things lining up, and you know they got really great actors.
It's pretty complex.
Every choice in this movie works off. Yeah, yeah.
It's layered. It's not simple,
And it all plays well and pays off in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Even like they establish like Picard saying we need to target these like plasma cooling conduits early on because it'll dissolve organic flesh. Like that's such a great Chekhov's
right.
plasma coolant conduit because you'd forgotten that by the time, but then you know when Data is resistance is futile and smashes it, like you instantly are like, oh yes. Fuck, I know what's going to happen. This is going to completely destroy the Borg. Data's going to be fine, and
Picard might be killed.
Picard, this might go down. And it's such an epic shot, Data coming out of that soup and like half of his face is Terminator and his hands all Terminator and he grabs the queen and brings her back. It's great. And they also set up like so many great things like, you know, Picard's special affection for Data, like early in the season, like he would get so irritated by Data's pedantry.
Yeah.
But here it's like, you know, when Data's trying to do the feeling of the Phoenix and, you know, like, and Data's just like, I just don't get it. I'm feeling these microfractures and the titanium. And Picard's just kind of got his eyes closed. And he just smiles because he loves Data. And this is Data. And, you know, he's no longer annoying. He's like, you wouldn't want him any other way. Right. So,
yeah,
Picard going back and sacrificing himself potentially for his friend, you know, that's the only thing in Picard that really works is the idea that. You know, Data and Picard have a special relationship going back from Picard being forced to defend his, you know, sentience in a Federation trial. It's great. All this stuff works.
It is. I really like it. Oh, let me give you one more cringe or cool.
All right.
You broke your little ships.
It's cool. It's the perfect flat delivery because you can't escalate from Picard's, you know,
oh, no.
the line must be drawn here.
Yeah.
That's such a meme in our like every fucking board game.
Dude.
Every fucking board game before the dice are rolled.
You'd be get backed into Australia playing Risk and the line must be drawn at Perth or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I let him take Europe and I fell back. I let him take Asia and I fell back. All the way in Australia. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's good. It's good.
I do too.
And it takes you know, like Picard's temper tantrum and shows it out for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I fucking love the design of the Phoenix. Someone should get a fucking medal for making a recognizably Star Trek looking nacelle thing fit into like an ICBM delivery system. Like those, like I almost clapped when those nacelles folded out because I'm like, what is this? What guy? I saw it. It looks like almost like a Battlestar Galactica ship, you know? And I'm like, what the fuck? What the fuck is this? But when it like blows its hatch and those things fold out. Fucking is the tits.
The thing I love about this the most is that it feels like the old days of rocketry where a rocket ship was just a tiny ass cockpit strapped to a huge bomb, right? Like a fucking nuclear level explosion, pretty much.
Yeah.
And this harkens back to that. This thing is a cockpit that can fit three people barely on top of a warp core and two nacelles. That is it. There is nothing. Yeah. There are no creature comforts in this thing whatsoever. It's kind
There's
of
no
amazing.
Anti-gravity. We still have to spin the whole rocket's worth of delta V to get this fucker into orbit.
Right?
Yeah.
I think this is such a great bridge. It is. Yeah. This is, to me, feels like where Enterprise's head was at, trying to get to that level. Like that era of you know, stellar travel.
Yeah.
I feel like they nailed it here.
They made it seem too futuristic. But yeah, if they could have found a baby step for me between here and the old series, which kind of looked a little Erector Seti. Uh-huh. Like I think they could have had something, but cringe or cool. Whatever the fuck is going on with the hoses in engineering?
Are those not Borg hoses? Are those like sentient, like semi-sentient Borg controlled hoses?
I think this has always been my headcanon. Here's the two things that could, I don't know. Yeah, if it's the Borg trying to attack, you know, the Borgified Enterprise. Uh-huh. There's two things that make sense. Back in the old series movies, they had this conceit where the engineering guys wore these like full costumes that could quickly have like a hood put over them and like an oxygen hose snapped into them. And it makes a lot of fucking sense when you're working with an antimatter reactor that, you know, you might have to do work in the vacuum of space that you would have like these functional engineering kind of like radiation suits and stuff. And like, if they were still doing that in engineering and these hoses came down as like an automatic clip into the emergency systems of the ship,
gotcha.
Makes a lot of sense. If there is, in case of flesh eating plasma dispensed, like grappling cables that come down so crew can grab on them and climb to safety.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. But the way these things are animated, they do feel like some kind of malevolent Borg thing coming down to fuck with Picard.
Yeah. No, it's always been my headcanon that they were coming down to get him.
Hissing, like,
and he
snakes
just,
and,
right?
And he's just like, fuck this, I'm gonna climb you. But I think everyone overlooks it because hot Picard. Patrick Stewart put on a fucking gun show in this scene.
He progressively strips throughout this movie. I love it. It's hilarious. It's like he's Predator, right?
Or Die Hard.
Sure.
Like, if he takes off his boots, he's John McClane in this final scene.
Yeah, for sure.
Barefoot and dress pants and the A-frame wife beater, Federation issued wife beater.
Sure. Oh, another thing about this scene with the organic tissue eating cloud. What do they do to Data's eye? Because when Data comes out and you're talking about, you know, the Terminator look that he's got.
Yeah.
His eye is gone, too. Now,
it's just a flat surface. Yeah.
Yeah. Just flat metal or whatever he's made of. Does that mean there's normally organic tissue on Data's eyes?
I think so. I would think those would be ceramic or something.
Well, no, it means that the Borg have replaced his non-organic eye material because one of his eyes is fine. So the Borg have done something to his eye as well.
You're right. God damn, I'm gonna have to go back and watch that scene again because you're right.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have.
That was not how I would design a cyborg eye.
No,
it'd be like if his teeth were eaten away too, and they just had like metal stubs. Like, wouldn't you just put like fake teeth in the robot's head? You know, like
you'd think so. Yeah,
wouldn't you have like a glass eye or something in the robot's body? Yeah,
yeah, it's wild.
I didn't think they were organic. But yeah, man, that pun. Yeah, Data reaching out like and pulling the Borg Queen, and the Borg Queen's getting dissolved, and was a fitting like fuck yeah death because it looked painful and slow and definitive. Yeah. And then, of course, Picard doing the neck snap. And this is an easy one. This is the easiest cringe or cool you're ever going to get. Data's thinking about betraying the Federation.
Very cool. Very cool.
That whole sequence is such a great... Because you think he's just like being honest about it. And he kind of is. But like, you know, that... You know, even for he's like thought about it for like 3 nanoseconds or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. It's great delivery.
It is. I've seen it so many times. I know the lines he's going to deliver, but they still work, even though I know what's coming.
Yeah, it's too bad because it would have been that much stronger had he not given away the farm with the to hell with these orders earlier on in the movie. But what are you going to do? It's damn near a perfect Star Trek movie.
It is. I've got one more question for you before we get out of here.
Hit me.
Or before I'm pretty much done talking about it. Although I could talk for another hour on this.
Oh, for sure.
All right. You've heard of the Prime Directive, correct?
I've heard it talked about, sure.
All right. As a refresher for people, the Prime Directive prohibits Starfleet from interfering in the development of any pre-warp civilization, right? That's in a nutshell.
Can't do it.
How does that apply to a pre-warp Earth? Do they break the Prime Directive here?
Man, it's a gray area, even without thinking about it too much, because this was supposed to be Earth's being post-warp, and the Borg are interfering with the natural development of the Earth. So, like,
so are they breaking the Prime Directive to preserve the Prime?
Because that's the thing, is like the Borg are the ones interfering with the timeline. And Picard cleaning it up doesn't strike me like it's like the least harmful thing, I guess, especially since the importance of Earth to the Federation can't be understated. Like, probably the whole rest of the Federation falls to the Borg. So, like, if there's a time to skirt close to breaking the Prime Directive, like, Picard will go on to break the Prime Directive next movie just because he's got teenage blood in him and he's horny and he thinks the right. The planet lady's hot. So, like,
he does break it often. Yeah.
Saving all of humanity and probably the Federation too.
The Federation. The Federation never would have started, right? Because it started on Earth.
No, because I thought the Vulcans were kind of like the founding fathers of the Federation. And, you know, they had already
never would have met the Vulcans.
Like the Andorians and right. You're right.
That's the thing. So it makes total sense that they are, because in this movie, it's very clear that they are observing the Prime Directive, right? They know about our civilization, but they're not interested because we haven't done warp flight yet. And the thing that makes them interested and come down to our planet signature. Is that warp signature. So, you know, whatever spawned the Federation was clearly either influenced or was the Vulcans based on this.
Yeah.
Because they observed the Prime Directive before we did.
Yeah. It actually makes me wonder, and I don't know if this was addressed in Enterprise. I don't know how the hell Earth got the fucking seat of the Federation.
Right.
Like, it does seem like we're one of
the... We convinced them logically. We said, we're most central.
We pulled some Ferengi shit. We threw a temper tantrum. We did brain the Vulcans. Like, you know, we just don't care as much as they do. Let them have it.
They're logical, emotional. To not deal with this bullshit.
I think the Vulcans are the mommies and daddies of the Federation. Mm-hmm. we're the screaming man children. I love this movie. Happy 25th anniversary to it. I've probably seen this movie 20, 30 times now.
Yeah. One of my all time favorite movies.
It is still super entertaining. Very quotable. It's like, it's the best movie if you're just a big TNG fan, that like every, whoever is your favorite's got a moment to shine where they can be funny or be cool. And, it's a real showcase for Picard, Data, and Worf, but everybody's got a little something to do. Like I said, if they brought back Ro Laren, I would have like, that'd just be perfect. You know, we got Barkley. So pretty cool. That's it. I hope you guys have enjoyed our nostalgic look back at Star Trek First Contact. Also, if you are a Star Trek fan and you didn't know, every Sunday at 8 PM, me and Jim sit down on twitch.tv/baldmove and we watch a Star Trek Next Generation classic episode. We're, in the early goings of season 5 right now. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can show up and watch the thing synchronized. You can watch the thing. You can watch our commentary. It's all synchronized. It's easy peasy. Hang out with the cool community of Bald Move. It's a good time. So if you're a Trek fan or a science fiction fan, check out those Sci-Fi Sunday streams, 8 p.m. Eastern every Sunday. Of course, we'll probably have some fun, you know, some aberrations of the holidays and all that coming up. Mm-hmm. But check it out. I think you'd really enjoy it. That's it. We'll see you with another pulp series or prestige film very soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you, everybody.